Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A Chinook helicopter shot down last weekend in Afghanistan south of Kabul. 30 Americans dead, 38 in total, including 22 Navy SEALs. The heavy blow, the biggest one-time U.S. loss of life in this long war, spotlights the growing role that U.S. Special Operations Forces have taken in Afghanistan. More than a dozen raids a night on high-value targets, a grueling tempo of operations, a central role that may grow further as regular troop levels are pulled down in Afghanistan. Is it too much strategically, humanly? This hour on Point, the growing role of Special Operations Forces in Afghanistan and beyond. You can join the conversation. From the raid that killed bin Laden to this chopper crash, why are we hearing more about Special Operations Forces? Are we placing too much burden on these elite troops? Are they stretched too thin? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The news came in, broke early Saturday morning. Here's CNN senior Pentagon correspondent Barbara Starr reporting from Washington that morning.
At this point, the U.S. military is absolutely reeling at the news. Several U.S. government officials now tell CNN that the majority of those killed in this incident are believed to be U.S. Navy SEALs. That's U.S. Navy Special Forces, the very types of troops that, of course, conducted that raid against Osama bin Laden.
The news broke like a wave across military families, families of SEAL members, SEAL Team 6 members, in fact, who were not accustomed to all kinds of public attention. But here it was. Petty Officer Michael Strange of Philadelphia was one of those 22 SEALs. 25-year-old had just been engaged, purchased a house in Virginia Beach, Virginia. His father and brother recalled his service to an ABC's news affiliate in Virginia.
Michael loved protecting our country. We were very proud of him.
It was something he was trained for. It was something he wanted. He's going over. It's flip of a coin if he comes back or not.
But the number of deployments and the tempo of operations, nearly unprecedented at this point. We will hear in this hour from a SEAL Team 6 veteran of operations in Afghanistan. But joining us now from Washington is Tom Bowman, Pentagon correspondent for NPR. Tom, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us from Monterey, California, is Caleb Sepp. He's senior lecturer in defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Also former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Counterterrorism. A former Green Beret officer, Army Special Forces. Caleb Sepp, welcome back to you as well. Hello, Caleb. Are you there?
Yes, right here.
Great. It's great to have you. Tom Bowman, please recount for us, if you can at this point, all that is known at this point about what happened with this big Chinook coming down south-southeast of Kabul.
Well, what we know, Tom, is that the Chinook helicopter with 30 U.S. military folks on board, they were heading to help out another group of U.S. forces that was engaged in a firefight with the Taliban. And as they were coming in, this is at night, they were hit by what is believed to be a rocket-propelled grenade, brought down the helicopter, and then killed all aboard. And they quickly secured the site, and there seems to be no fighting after that. And then it was learned later they were not only Navy SEALs, but part of SEAL Team 6, which is a highly secretive anti-terror part of Navy SEALs. And there are only a couple of hundred of these SEALs. So the loss of 22 of them was really devastating, not only in a personal way to their families and comrades, but also because these guys are the most highly trained folks in the military. And it was a devastating loss to the community as well.
Caleb Sepp, this is a tragedy for these young soldiers' families. It's a heavy blow for the SEALs, but it also pulls back the covers a little bit for the American people about just how many Special Operations Forces missions are being carried out day in and day out, or I should say night in and night out in Afghanistan. More than a dozen, we're told, every night, and these are dangerous, going into dangerous situations, high-value targets and all the rest, night after night. What about this tempo of operations, Caleb Sepp?
Actually, Tom, the number of raids is sometimes up to 70 per night And this has been actually covered. It's been touched on in open press before, but
yes.
Certainly this this tragic event has re-energized interest in what's going on. But the night raids, as they're called, became a very important part of General Dave Petraeus's strategy inside Afghanistan to press the Taliban to toward negotiation.
Describe for us, if you would, Caliph Sepp, what these night raids generally look like or mean. Where are they going? How are they getting there? What are they doing when they arrive?
I can only speak in very general terms
yes.
about this for obvious reasons. But again, another former commander that had served both Iraq and Afghanistan had optimized the cycle of finding, fixing, and then closing in on the enemy, finishing them off, and then exploiting the intelligence that was discovered on site or, you know, gained from prisoners. And that was instantly analyzed and represented as operationally valuable information for a succeeding raid that would occur the very next night, so as to never let the pressure off the enemy.
So what kind of situations are they going into on these raids?
Often what's been depicted, again, I'll refer to open source
yes.
Documents in the press because they're fairly consistent. Is locating Taliban leaders who, as you know, don't actually live in separate military camps in most cases, but live in villages or small compounds. And it takes various intelligence sources, human sources, electronic and technical means to locate them. And when they're found, the chances that are taken is trying to approach them in as stealthy a means or as rapid a means as possible to close in and capture those person, the enemy that have been chosen.
Tom Bowman, the kind of force array that's being described here, is it there are different levels of special forces, and often we may see one level go in for the first part of the attack, correct me if I'm wrong, and with others, maybe SEAL Team 6 standing by in case they get in trouble to come in behind and help or clean up. What do you know about this sort of the way it unfolds, Tom?
Well, from what I understand, SEAL Team 6 is the most elite of the special operations forces, and you would send them in, again, for a high-value target. They went in, of course, to get Osama bin Laden back in May.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, generally, I think Caleb is right that you're talking about dozens and dozens of raids each night, and all the special forces do this. A couple of years ago, we were with a Green Beret team in western Afghanistan, and we were allowed to see some of their training of Afghan commandos. But one night they went out as we were sleeping and took out a Taliban leader. They all went out in ATV vehicles, all-terrain vehicles,
mm-hmm.
To get this guy, and then came back all dirty and dusty the next morning. They were out on an all-night mission. So, again, these folks do a lot of training of Afghan forces. Some of them go out on these night raids. But there's a huge number of these night raids going on.
Caleb Sepp, what about the toll on these forces of going out night after night? And these are killing missions, killer capture, but very often, as you well know, killing missions. These soldiers are trained for this. On the other hand, a dozen, 15, 70 of these missions a night, that must mean these guys are doing this night after night after night.
It is simply what they have been selected for. These are beyond the training that you just mm-hmm. mentioned and that Tom Bowman has been talking about. You know, remember that these personnel were put through a very lengthy and very arduous selection processes to find people that have that level of physical power and endurance, that level of commitment, the high intelligence it takes to be able to deal with rapidly changing situations. It requires them to be very adaptive, very flexible, and to be able to move between missions, exactly as Tom described, upon the one hand training the Afghan security forces and then conducting their own missions, sometimes unilaterally, sometimes in combination with Afghans.
But even for these highly trained soldiers, this tempo of operations has to be grueling, and you've pointed out the evidence of that is coming in the, you know, retention here. These guys are doing their tour in special forces and increasingly leaving.
This has been a point of concern for the senior leadership of the broader special operations community, both the Marines, the Army, and the Navy SEALs as well, for several years. The Rangers, in particular, which are a superb strike force, a direct action force, and of course involved in this incident over the weekend, in their own night raid operation, are having a very high departure of young soldiers who come in and serve their enlistment. Mm-hmm. And do splendidly well, but at the point that they've received the experience and the training necessary to become mid-grade leaders, squad leaders, they leave the service because the deployments are so long and so arduous.
Tom Bowman, we just have half a minute before the break, but there may be a strategic issue here. The expectation has been that as troop levels overall are pulled down in Afghanistan, already we may be seeing a greater role by special forces. This is not just a one-night story that ended in tragedy that we're looking at. This is telling us something about the overall shape of the operation in Afghanistan, Tom.
Absolutely, and they're increasing the number of special operators because they are sort of a Swiss Army knife. They can do everything. They can do training. They can do night ops. They can do all these other kind of operations. But it is true that there's a huge concern now about overstretching these folks. Some of them have been at war now for 10 years, rarely at home, and there's a concern about what they call the fraying of the force. It's a real big issue now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about U.S. Special Operations Forces in Afghanistan and around the world, looking at how they're used and if they are stretched too thin after the big helicopter downing southeast of Kabul on Saturday. Tom Bowman, Pentagon correspondent for NPR, who has spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, joins us today from Washington. From Monterey, California, Caleb Sepp is with us. He's a former Green Beret officer, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Counterterrorism. We'll hear later in this hour from a SEAL Team 6 veteran who has worked in Afghanistan. Tom, Caleb, let me take a call right here from Amy in Bellows Falls, Vermont. Amy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone I have spoken to has voiced the fear that perhaps one of the Afghans who is ostensibly working with the U.S. may be passing pertinent information along to the Taliban to continue to stir up trouble. I was wondering whether the special forces or the regular military speak much of the local language. I mean, if they're conversing between themselves, if you don't speak the language, you don't know what they're saying. But it seems so many of the elite forces killed all at once. Was there a leak someplace?
Was there a leak? Let us pick it up, Amy. Tom Bowman, you know this scene. First of all, I mean, there were also 8 Afghans on that Chinook with 38 dead in total, 8 Afghans among them. But what about the possibility? Why did this happen? Is it a possibility of a leak? There's now reporting today in the Washington Post asking if they really should have gone in there, if the Army Rangers who were ahead of them there could have dealt with the situation on their own. There's been speculation that this was, in fact, a kind of trap, elaborate trap set by the Taliban, knowing that there would be a rescue mission set in if the Rangers appeared to be in trouble in this narrow valley. What about that range of questions, Tom?
Well, there's no evidence at this point that there was any kind of a leak. But that being said, there is a great concern about turncoats within the Afghan military ranks. One officer I talked with when I was there in June said that's his prime concern. But in this particular case, as the Chinook helicopter was coming in, and remember, this is it in the dark of night, and they always go in without lights on, mm-hmm. So it's even hard to see them come in. At this point, they believe it was a lucky shot from a rocket-propelled grenade. There's no sense of any kind of any tip-off of the Taliban.
And coming into a narrow valley here, the military sources today telling the Post, at least, maybe you as well, Tom, that indeed it was not a crash, but a shoot-down by the Taliban.
Oh, absolutely. Everyone is saying at this point it was a shoot-down. They believe it was a rocket-propelled grenade, but at this point the investigation is ongoing. But clearly, yeah, it was a shoot-down. It was not a crash.
Calisep, does it look like just a lucky shot to you, or does it look like it could have at the least been canny, careful, ultimately tragic for U.S. soldiers, Taliban planning here?
Let me paint a scenario for Amy and remind her that while we have been at war in this way that Tom has been recounting, that is beginning to fray some of our forces, the Taliban have been at war for 10 years. And as a company commander once told me several years ago, as he discussed how tough the Taliban were to fight, he said, "We've killed the stupid ones." So they they're very much aware of our tactics, and which drives us to try and be more flexible, change patterns of activity. But if a unit gets in trouble, there will be Taliban commanders who are savvy enough to know that at some point the Americans might send or the NATO forces might send a reaction force, and that usually arrives by helicopter. So they could feasibly set up a helicopter ambush to specifically for that.
And this would be the helicopter's most vulnerable moment as it slowly comes in for landing with little room to maneuver, Caleb.
This has been known since Vietnam, and where we lost almost 3,000 helicopters during the Vietnam War, many of them to rocket-propelled grenades. The Black Hawk helicopter that was shot down in Mogadishu was shot down by rocket-propelled grenades. In 2005, the Chinook that came to bring a reaction force to rescue a SEAL reconnaissance team that was pinned down was shot down by a rocket-propelled grenade. This is it's a vulnerability of these big heart cargo helicopters.
Tom Bowman, let me ask you a big picture question. We are on track, we're told, for the major drawdown by 2014 in Afghanistan of U.S. and NATO troop levels there. Now, we know that the Pentagon doesn't really like this. This was resisted by David Petraeus and others there saying no, but that's the schedule we're on. Now, you cannot but look at this and wonder, are we asking Special Operations Forces to fill the gap? Because as my understanding is their numbers are not being drawn down, but regular troops will be filtering away. Online, our listeners are saying over and over, let's just get out of there, but the Pentagon doesn't want to do that, not under current circumstances anyway. Are we asking Special Operations Forces to be Superman, kind of filling the gap as we pull away from Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think in the future years, you could see them filling the gap and being even more busy than they are now. And you're right, there is a concern among military leaders that you're pulling the troops out of Afghanistan too quickly. The real concern is a large number that would come out next year before the fighting season ends around November, that a lot of these troops would come out during the summer. So there is a lot of concern about that. How do you reconfigure the forces? Some are saying that the campaign plan may have to be written by General John Allen, who's now the top commander there, or they may have to kind of pull back to the more populated areas and sort of forget about or just lightly cover some of these other areas. There are a few Taliban fighters. So there's a real concern about how you put all this together, particularly next year. But you're right. I mean, you could leave these special operators to do a lot more work once the more conventional forces start to pull out.
Caleb Sepp, are we leaving special forces to deal with a kind of contradiction in American foreign policy views? A lot of Americans look at the polls now, especially with all the fiscal pressure on. They simply want to be out of there, but there's not a full commitment at the Pentagon to that. You know, are we leaving the special operations forces kind of stuck in the middle?
Let me leave the political aspect of that that question aside. That's those are issues internal to the current administration.
We will a little bit, but it's a democracy, so they never should go away, should they?
Well, part of what the armed forces would tell you is that special operations forces are designed exactly to do the mission that is being laid out for them right now.
This is sort of the Joe Biden view from early on. Just have special targeted hits to keep the Taliban from overrunning Kabul and get the big numbers out.
What's come out of that, the sort of a synthesis of the arguments, is that purely trying to do what Mr. Biden had originally argued for, which is keep soft special operations forces, soft as they're called inside the community. to do counter-terrorist raids, but in fact they would have to continue to do training, what's doctrinally called military assistance or foreign internal defense, training of the Afghan security forces to keep building their capability and their capacity to defend their own country.
It still looks like, it looks to me as though they may be asked to do a harder and harder job. Let me get a call right here from Frankfort, Kentucky. Greg, you're on the air.
Hey, I've got a few years with the 160th a while back, and I'm retired military.
160th Special Operations Command.
Mm-hmm. It always seemed that they wanted to rely on the Chinooks to do jobs more to justify their existence within the command structure when they have better tools for these jobs, especially the newer model Blackhawks. And I'm wondering how that plays into this.
It's
the political ramifications of using the Chinooks to justify their existence.
That's an interesting question. We have a lot of callers and listeners asking that, Tom and Caleb. You know, why so many soldiers in one big, old, relatively slow helicopter? I'm looking here at a BBC report saying the British don't do it. They don't put so many highly trained soldiers in one chopper. What about it, Tom Bowman?
Well, I mean, clearly the Chinook is sort of the is the main way these special operators get to the fight. I mean, it's a huge helicopter. Picture a bus with rotors on it. It's massive.
Yeah.
I've been in many of them myself. And you can put several dozen people on this. And with a Black Hawk helicopter, a smaller one, I think you can put, besides, the, you know, 12 people on that. So it's a much larger helicopter. The problem is that it is slow-moving and lumbering.
Why not two Blackhawks instead of one big old sky bus?
I don't know. Maybe Caleb can answer that.
Caleb?
You know, part of that answer is that it has nothing. You know, I would say I've never heard a political argument about employment of any Chinook helicopter anywhere, whether it's the conventional model, the CH-47s, or the special operations model, the MH-47s. The fact is it is a tremendously powerful helicopter and can operate at the very high altitudes that it's required to in Afghanistan, where Black Hawk helicopters actually have trouble getting sufficient lift.
Mm-hmm.
This was one of the problems during the raid to Abbottabad, Pakistan, where the Osama bin Laden's compound was at such an altitude, the Black Hawk helicopter pilots actually had difficulty controlling their helicopters. That's what caused the crash inside the compound.
Yep. Pete in Boston. Pete, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, yeah. Listen, Tom, one of your loyal listeners, an old veteran here myself, I think what a lot of the civilians don't understand, and the reaction is that this is a classic. The Navy SEALs were a reactionary force. Every time you send an American group out, you have to have a reactionary force, and the special op guys are very well trained, and that was they were trying to come to the aid of the Rangers.
Yeah.
And again, kudos to all these guys, the special ops and the Marines in particular. Other point I was making is that the civilians have no idea of the casualties that the special ops, and also, for example, Marine infantry. One of the outfits just came back, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, in the last 6 months deployed, had 29 killed and 140 wounded. I mean, that doesn't get any press anywhere. They're fighting. They just came out. Now the Marine outfits, you know, fighting in different areas. But those are the type of casualties that come out there. And in Vietnam, I can tell you, I heard it mentioned that we had helicopters shot down, and you'd lose 20, 25 guys in a platoon if they hit it. Those RPGs are devastating.
No question about it. Of course, the biggest one-day loss in the history of the war here, but the casualties go on day after day. And obviously, you're right, Pete. It's not just by any means Special Operations Forces, and I appreciate your call. Tom Bowman, Caleb Sepp, please stand by. Joining us right now from New Jersey is Nick Terse. He's associate editor of TomDispatch.com, author of the piece How Many Secret Wars Are We Fighting?, which was published on Tom Dispatch and on Salon.com. Nick Terse, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Pull back the curtain for us a little bit globally. I was astounded by some of the numbers that your reporting and others have brought us on how many countries around the world Special Operations Forces are now active in. What is that picture, Nick?
Yeah, I was shocked myself. You know, last year I had read in a very good piece in the Washington Post that said that during the last years of the Bush presidency, special ops forces were active in about 60 countries around the world. And then they said that, you know, since Obama had taken over, the special ops had been deployed in 75 countries. But when I talked to Colonel Tim Nye over at Special Operations Command, he said that the number would likely reach 120 by the end of this year.
This is well over half the countries in the world with U.S. Special Forces in them. What are they doing?
Well, it's a, you know, it's a very good question. You know, and this is something that, as you might imagine, you know, Special Ops doesn't tell you what they're doing in each country. But, I mean, we know that they run high-profile assassination missions like the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, that they engage in low-level targeted killings with drones in places like, you know, Pakistan and Somalia and Yemen. They run capture kidnap operations, these kick-down-the-door night raids, joint operations with foreign forces, and a lot of training missions with indigenous partners around the world. It's, you know, that's really part of a shadowy conflict that's unknown to most Americans.
This has been pumped up a lot during the Obama administration, after growth in the Bush administration as well. Why? Is this because the threat has grown? Is it because it's you can use these forces with less public exposure?
Well, I think public exposure is one facet of it. You know, these forces have really grown in the period since 9/11. The Special Operations Command was established in the late 80s, in 1987, and since that time, I mean, it was steadily growing, but since 9/11, it's grown exponentially. We're looking at a force of about 60,000 members of Special Operations Command right now. About a third of them are career members of SOCOM. The rest cycle through the command. Since 9/11, SOCOM's baseline budget has it's almost tripled, and if you add in funding for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, you're looking at you know, almost a quadrupling of it. And over that time, the number of personnel deployed abroad has jumped fourfold as well.
And Tom Bowman, I'm reading in the New York Times today that not only are they much more active around the world, but special operations veterans are taking increasingly important high positions in the U.S. General Military Command, Tom. Why? What's driving them higher up the command structure?
Well, I think the fact, as we've been talking about, they're in much more use today than they were maybe 15, 20 years ago. The number I've seen is there are roughly 12,000 special operators working in these 75 or plus countries. And you're right, doing everything from night raids and takedowns to training missions. So they're much more high profile than they were just a number of years ago. And I think you're seeing that with the generals and admirals rising up in the ranks.
Nick, we've just got you for another minute. Is this the future of the U.S. military? Not so much huge standing armies in old-fashioned, you know, rank-on-rank war, but special operations forces all over the place.
I mean, it sure looks like it to me. I think it's you know, this command is really ascendant, and you mentioned that, you know, these special ops veterans are rising in the hierarchy. So I think you'll see, you know, a lot more Pentagon dollars going their way and a lot more missions.
Nick Turse with TomDispatch.com, Salon.com. Thank you very much for joining us today, Nick.
Thank you.
Calif Sepp, is this the future? I mean, traditionally there's been tension between traditional military units and special operations forces. The training is very different. Is it a new military profile emerging here?
Well, you've just asked two questions, but to get to what Nick Turse was talking about is very interesting comments that this is really more back to the future is what he's describing. The 9/11 is the dividing line, but before 9/11, special operations forces were in on the average 85 countries a day, but you know, you have to consider the numbers that are involved there. Sometimes that is a single civil affairs officer, you know, or two special forces medics.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about U.S. Special Operations Forces in Afghanistan and around the world, looking at how they're used and if they are stretched too thin after the big helicopter downing southeast of Kabul on Saturday. 30 Americans died in that crash, 38 total, almost two dozen U.S. Special Forces and many from the Navy SEAL Team 6. We've been speaking with Kalev Sepp at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Counterterrorism, himself former Green Beret officer, that's Army Special Forces, and Tom Bowman, Pentagon correspondent for NPR. Joining us right now from Whitefish, Montana, Montana State Senator Ryan Zinke. He spent 23 years in the Navy SEALs, including 8 years in SEAL Team 6, where he served around the world, including in Afghanistan. Ryan Zinke, Senator Zinke, thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Tom.
That's a very big number of your former comrades that we saw go down in Afghanistan on Saturday. Were you surprised, given the kind of work they're doing day in and day out and the volume at which they're doing it?
Well, you're always surprised at the loss of life, especially, you know, so many. And, you know, obviously the question at hand is, you know, to take care of the families, you know, first, and then look at short-term and near-term replacement of the force so we don't lose capability. You know, and your lead-in was correct. The special forces have been used more extensively in the last 10 years, and no doubt that's the future as well. Counterinsurgency and counterterrorism, there's kind of two parts, and special operations forces are in the countries, understanding the dynamics, understanding the good guys, the bad guys, where the weapons are, where the dynamics are. And in order to fight a counterinsurgency and a counterterrorism, you have to understand the field, and that's what we're seeing.
Is there a conflict between these two, Ryan Zinke, Senator Zinke? I mean, counterinsurgency during the day, you've got U.S. troops out there, you know, helping build civil society and build communities. At night, you know, in come the special operations teams, and that's counterterror. There's a lot of gunfire there. Do these fit together, or are they in tension with one another? We've seen civilian casualties and a lot of upset right to the top of the Afghan government about it.
Well, I think what we're seeing is you can, you know, be on a platform at sea and go in and do, you know, counter-terrorist strikes, but you really are not surgical in what you're doing unless you understand the field. And what we're seeing is a smaller group of special operations. You know, the countries don't want a large visible battalion, as years passed. And in order to understand the dynamics and work with the countries, because obviously the best solution is for the countries to solve their own problems. Well, when you have a lawless area or area where the government is not particularly strong, they do need assistance in identifying, you know, those forces that are anti-government or extremists, and they don't have the capability themselves, you know, to target, do the right analysis. So I think what we're seeing is kind of what we'll see in the next 15 to 20 years is smaller groups deployed throughout the world in an assistance role. But the two between counterterrorism and counterinsurgency, I they're related.
You know, polls show there are a lot of Americans who think we should just be getting out of Afghanistan. But I wonder, either way, if we're kind of fooling ourselves here. These are troops with enormous capacity, but they're not, at the end of the day, actually magical or supermen. I mean, is there a limit to how much you can ask of these troops to do these jobs? Is there a tempo of operations that begins to grind up this terrific capacity that has been developed?
Well, I use the words of Admiral Olson, who I was watching last night, and, you know, he says that, you know, the fabric is still strong, but the edges are being frayed, and I think that's correct. You know, we've been in sustained combat for over 10 years, which is the longest period in the history of our country, and these guys are deployed between 200 and 300 days out of the year, whether you're training stateside or deployed overseas. Most of them have done, you know, multiple deployments, as, you know, many as 10 or 12 deployments during that period. There's a lot of strain. You know, certainly the loss of life, as we just witnessed, you know, will put additional strain on the force. But, you know, and the growth, you know, it's very difficult to make special forces people. One is the job doesn't appeal to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
The training pipeline is extremely long. For the SEALs, it's 3.5 years just to be in harm's way the first time as a SEAL, which is a mouthful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a similar background and pipeline with the Green Berets when they do foreign language programs. And so the, you know, it takes a long time, you know, to make these special operations guys. And then when they're deployed so much, so long, there's a lot of strain at home. So I think we're seeing where the growth of the force is probably going to be 2 to 3% a year. Any more than that, I think you atrophy the skill level. And there is a goodness in having the special operations guys know each other for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Admiral Olson was talking that when he knows his people around him for 20 years. And when I was at the team, that's similar. I grew up with these guys. And there's a level of trust and competency among a group that's very familiar with each other's skills that's important.
But if we overwork them and they leave, as Caleb Sepp was saying, after, you know, just a few years, you don't get that maturity level or that length of time working together.
Well, that's exactly it, and there is a, and you know, make no mistake, they don't do it for the money.
Yeah, and we got that.
These guys are type A personalities. They do it because they recognize that they are the best in the world, and the pack runs very fast. I mean, when you look at the skills they have to have across the board, these guys truly represent the best our nation can put in the field. And there's a sense of pride. That's why they stay. But there is a breaking point where too much is too much. And, you know, I certainly SOCOM is looking at it. Admiral McCraven, who is replacing Admiral Olson, is very bright, understands the dynamics, and I'm sure that will be one of his top priorities.
Caleb Sepp, we've got here Bill writing us online saying, our military has shifted to using people until they are used up as a standard procedure. It has to stop. Ryan Zinke describes 200 or 300 of these night raids a year for an individual special operations member. I mean, you point out they are trained to do this work, but at some point, this is a lot of killing, and every night this must become just a basic challenge to these men, I guess, and their humanity.
Actually, you know, Tom, you've hit on something that is of has been recognized in the senior-most ranks of the Naval Special Warfare Command. That's the command that has the SEALs, has responsibility and commands the SEALs, and they're very aware of that, and they are pressing to mitigate that exactly that kind of that pressure. It's not 200 or 300 raids a year, but the sailors, the SEALs do experience a grinding schedule. But already the tours in Afghanistan are going to be reduced from 12 months for conventional forces down to 9 months, and special operations forces hopefully will also have more dwell time back in the United States before they're recommitted to the combat zone.
Ryan Zinke, I wanted to get you on that as well. Do you think we're at risk? Do we need to make changes to be sure that we don't burn out this special capacity?
Well, you know, we are at war, and these troops are making a difference. And you know, you're really cut between, you know, some pretty tough spots. Because on one side, if you try to increase the numbers beyond, you know, the normal pipeline, you'll atrophy the force and then you'll atrophy the skill. And you won't have as good of a force as you need. The other issue is the technology. You look at what the guys are doing out there.
Mm-hmm.
The injection and the integration of UAS platforms.
What does that mean? UAS platform?
Oh, unmanned aircraft system.
Oh, right, drone. Mm-hmm.
Which that portion of it is you have dogs in the handlers, and you have, you know, the degree of sophistication of the equipment on target as it has rapidly expanded, and it takes years to understand how to use the equipment and to leverage that technology. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what we're seeing is that the guys that maybe were in 20 years ago, they could have 5 years underneath their belt and be fine. It's just now that these additional skills that are required, you either have specialists with you, which they're doing in some cases, or your pipeline for training is longer, and the demand for yet more skilled, higher skilled individuals, is greater, and that's what we're seeing. I guess they understand what's at risk. They are making a difference. They are, I believe, they're winning in what they're doing. It's not a sprint. This is a marathon.
It's been long already. Ryan Zinke, yeah. Please stand by there if you would. And Tom Bowman, I want to come to you on this issue, but we've got a Special Forces member calling in. I want to turn to him before we got to let him go. John is calling. John, thank you very much for calling in.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to make two points that I'm sure Assistant Secretary Sepp would echo.
Mm-hmm.
The first is that the moniker Special Operations Forces is incredibly broad, and it includes an incredible number of specialties. I'm speaking from a U.S. Army Special Forces perspective, which is a very large portion of the SOF umbrella.
Right.
So the first is, when you say SOF, it's incredibly broad. The second point is, from a Special Forces perspective, a previous caller highlighted the direct action and potential clandestine and covert operations that are going on in these some number of countries he shouted out.
120, I think Nick Turse said, yes.
120, so... that is by far the minority of all actions happening both in all of these countries and in the declared war zones, Afghanistan and Iraq.
You're saying most is what, training, John, or?
Absolutely. And by most, I mean we're talking in the realm of 90-95%
mm-hmm.
is foreign internal defense training with host nation forces. And in these countries that aren't declared war zones, by law, we're not doing anything. We're not doing anything that's akin to what's being done in these declared war zones.
Even in Yemen, even in Somalia. I mean, we have taken
at the behest of and in coordination with the State Department. So those are the points I'd like to make, and I appreciate you having me on.
John, I appreciate your call. Special Forces member that right there calling in. Ryan Zinke, I know I've just got you for another minute here. Of course, our caller, current Special Forces, is correct. There's a lot of training going on. On the other hand, there have been operations outside, certainly declared war zone, whatever that means anymore, but in Yemen, in Somalia, where terrorists, we're told, have been taken out. There's all kinds of action here, Ryan Zinke.
Well, a concern is in the areas where you have either a lawless or a nearly lawless area, you cannot give the terrorists sanctuary. And that was obviously a concern in Afghanistan. It's a concern in Somalia. It's a concern in any area where these organizations can train, equip, and launch strikes from. So the U.S. is looking at that. The gentleman was correct. And most of the missions that SOF does, are not direct action. Most of them are intelligence preparation, looking at the networks, training foreign forces so they can operate on their own independently. That's the goal of the U.S. is for other people to solve their problems internally. But it is difficult, and some countries need more help than others.
Right.
And certainly, when the U.S. is in jeopardy, our policy has been and remains that the U.S. will strike if that danger is clear and present.
Ryan Zinke spent 23 years in the Navy SEALs, 8 in SEAL Team 6. He's now a Montana state senator joining us from Whitefish, Montana. Senator Zinke, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom. Have a great day.
You too. Tom Bowman, strategic implications here. If we're using Special Operations Forces more, big loss of life there last weekend, and of course not only Special Operations on that plane, but others as well. But does that mean the U.S. goes in more because it can do it on the QT, or does it go in militarily around the world less because there's a limited supply of these forces.
Well, it's hard to say exactly the strategic implications of this, but clearly they're increasing the size of the special operations community. It is a useful tool, as everyone was saying, both for training and for direct action. But clearly one of the problems here, as we talked about earlier, is the burnout factor. I personally know some special operators that are having marital troubles, family problems. They've been gone for most of the last decade in Afghanistan or Iraq, and they need a rest. And some have been asking for staff jobs back in the United States. So that's, in the near term, a particular problem that Admiral McCraven is going to have to deal with, the new head of the Special Operations Command.
Caliph Sepp, we just have half a minute here. The lesson you're taking from the big downing over the weekend of the Chinook and all the lives lost there, Caliph?
The lesson is that this command, and the command has taken the proper position, that this, which is a Churchillian view, which is that this is bad, this is tragic, but this is war, and we can't and we won't slacken our effort. We're going to continue to press these raids, and we'll fill these losses and fight on.
And now the American public as well absorbs and reaches its conclusions off of what it's seeing here. Certainly our sympathies to the families of all these special forces operators lost over the weekend. A terrible number. And beyond the special forces as well, everybody on that chopper, everybody there in Afghanistan. Caliph Sepp at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. It's always very good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
And Tom Bowman, Pentagon correspondent for NPR, great Pentagon correspondent. Tom, thanks for being here.
You're welcome, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.